The next matter on for oral argument this morning is, hope I'll pronounce this right, Owlett versus, or State of Minnesota versus Owlett. Council, please correct me later if I've mispronounced the name of the appellant. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. The timing restrictions are indicated in the lectern, which you can raise or lower. There's a button in the lectern to make, for your convenience. And the timing restrictions are indicated in the lectern as well. Please be mindful of those. Do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we keep only an audio recording. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed whenever you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, my belief is the name is Oulet, more of a French pronunciation.
Oulet. All right, thank you.
At least that's what I'm going to use. Good morning. My name is Peter Dahlquist. I am the attorney representing Todd Oulet before the court this morning. This is a case about emails that were sent leading up to May 7th, 2019. There's a lot of evidence in the record after that date, but regarding whether or not Mr. Oulet's conduct violated the threats of violence statute, the issue is whether or not the emails sent up to and before May 7th, 2019 violated that statute. Now, these violate the state's charges and the threats of violence statute as applied here violate Mr. Oulet's First Amendment right. Specifically, this is protected petitioning the government First Amendment speech. He sent an email to the BCA seeking specific information. The email was sent generally to the BCA and then it eventually was routed to JS. And I think that's one important distinction here from a lot of the other cases that have to do with, that are deemed to be true threats, is that he did not initially seek out JS. This kind of differs from Rosinski. It differs from Counterman versus Colorado, where the defendant was seeking out a specific individual. Here it's important to note that he initially sent the email to the BCA and the emails got routed to JS and she was responding because of her role within the Bureau.
Why does the fact, I just need you to expand on that a bit. I mean, eventually then he has direct communication with JS and that is, you know, this 5719 email. Why does the fact that it was a general one routed to her make a difference?
I think it goes to whether or not it was a true threat or not. Because in Counterman, in Rosinski, where the action was directed to a specific person, mm-hmm. those people were the source of that communication from the outset. So it goes to a little bit, JS on May 7th, 2019, doesn't have any reason to fear that he is reaching out to her for any reason other than what he's doing. He's emailing the Bureau asking for personal information about himself.
Right, but after that, after he knows that his emails are now going to a specific person.
I think it actually goes to the threat, the true threat of it, though. I mean, it goes to, because she doesn't have any reason to be fearful of him otherwise. So like Mrazinski. Mrazinski was a case where these...
What do you mean otherwise?
Well, she wasn't otherwise singled out by him.
But what do you mean otherwise singled out? At that point, he has her name and addresses her directly.
I agree with you, but...
So I'm trying to get a sense of what do you mean not singling her out point?
So what I'm getting at is he's not otherwise... It's not a situation where he's stalking her, contacting her through Facebook, finding her through any other means. Mrazinski, where there's an axe to grind, the woman in Mrazinski actually was contacting these people who had a CHIPS case against her. Counterman, it was some random kind of stalking type behavior. This is an interaction specifically with, to be honest, with a purpose. He is seeking information from the Bureau.
Okay, what about, but anyway, I got your name. At that point, isn't it clear that she's being singled out?
I think it's clear that he's contacting her and talking to her. I agree with that. But I don't think she's necessarily being singled out, because I think if you look at the context of these emails, right around that date, the issue is identity. He is asking for information. She is sending to him various laws and policies about verifying his identity. And he's having some issue with what she's saying, the hoops she's making him jump through. And so I think it's right in that context.
You know, further in that same exchange that Judge Ross was referencing, and he says, sure, most mass shootings by angry people occur at schools and businesses, but I would not push my luck if I were you, speaking directly to JS.
I think this is where the crux of this case lies. I mean, it is a general statement first. Absolutely.
But would you agree that it narrows to specifically to JS?
I think it narrows a bit. I think it pertains to his frustration with her behavior there. I agree. But I don't think the threat is as specific.
How can you get more specific than, paraphrasing, sometimes people who lose it kill a bunch of people in the organization, but I'm looking at you in this case, you.
I think part of the issue that I have with this sentence is the lack of pronouns, the lack of I'm going to come and do something specific. I'm going to come to the BCA and shoot you. I'm going to come to the BCA and commit
Fair
a mass
enough.
Shooting.
But as it regards the First Amendment?
I think this is a case that's similar to Watts. I mean, Watts is the case where the draftee is...
Put it a different way. If this statement is characterized as a direct threat, you agree that there's no First Amendment protection?
I think it does veer outside of that. Yes. I don't think it necessarily is it protected or is it First Amendment speech or is it not? But I do think if it's a true threat, yes, then that's not protected. Yeah. I wasn't trying to be evasive.
I understand. You've got to make the argument. In what way is that not a true threat?
I don't think this is a true threat because I think it's much like Watts. It's much like some of the other cases where there's hyperbole to this.
That's hyperbole?
I think the first statement is hyperbole.
Most mass shootings by angry people occur at schools and businesses, but I would not push my luck if I were you. That has the nature of being hyperbolic.
I think it does. I think it's a little bit it's more hyperbole than if you would have said, I'm going to come and I'm going to shoot you. And I think that's also why it's
slightly less specific.
It is.
How is the non-specific or slightly less specific nature of it converted from a threat to hyperbole?
I think it goes to also the believability of this, where he doesn't say, I'm coming for you. I'm coming to you. It's a venting. I read this as a venting of frustration. Is that first half of the sentence is these horrendous acts happen. I'm really frustrated with your customer service. You deal with people all the time. That's what he's saying. You deal with taxpayers all the time. And your behavior is frustrating. I think if you go to the next.
That is perhaps the most generous euphemistic description of a comment like this I've ever heard.
Well, particularly since it follows his clear statement that he knows who she is. He's got her name. He can look her up. And he says, it amazes me how, you government scum openly use your names treating people this way. I mean, so he's really focused on her as an individual before this.
I agree. There is those statements. The part of the entire context of this interaction on May 7th, does have to do with identity. And she's continually saying, you need to verify your identity. And he's saying, well, now I have your identity. I think that's part of the context that you look up as you look down in that email exchange, and he's saying that you can look me up. I could look you up like you looked me up.
So would you agree that this was a threat for the purpose of intimidation?
I don't think it was a threat for the purpose of intimidation. I think this was a threat trying to get information. Because that's what I think the record shows is that he was trying to get this information he was seeking, and he was frustrated with the requirements that the BCA was saying he had to follow.
So let's talk about recklessness then, because I think that's what we're looking at here. Now, it was his intent, but was this reckless with respect to he consciously disregarded this risk that this communication was going to be viewed as threatening and violent?
So was he consciously disregarding that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the question. That's the next question, at least in the analysis.
So I think I raise the argument that the Spriegel evidence was should not have been admitted. But I actually think the Spriegel evidence kind of cuts both ways. I mean, he has these instances that are presented to the court where he's used similar language, more caustic language, even what I would argue is a little bit more violent language, and he hasn't been investigated, and he hasn't been charged, and he hasn't gone to court for those matters. So in terms of a conscious risk, whether he's disregarding a known risk, the Spriegel evidence shows he's done and communicated emails like this before without a response back saying, this person was scared that you would act on this.
So because he wasn't called on it, that means that it wasn't a conscious disregard of how it might be taken?
I mean, he's got several instances where he's had the same speech, the same emails that he sent out, with no response from anyone. In some ways, it reinforces that that's not a conscious disregard because he's acted this way in the past and not been charged. And to his knowledge, I don't think he even knew he'd been investigated in the past.
Is the question of whether it's reckless, is that an objective or a subjective determination?
I think it's an objective determination. I think, to be honest, I think if we kind of dovetail it a little bit into the reasonable apprehension of fear of harm that's contained within the threats of violence statute, I think there has to be a little bit of both. There's got to be a subjective fear. That's one of the things that this court really focused on in Ketterling last year, was that there was no subjective fear of an actual person. But then in addition to that, there has to be some objective fear. Is the threat something that I think a reasonable person would be scared from? And I think you have to look at the context of the actual, like in this instance, the actual May 7th email. A lot of what was heard at the trial court had to do with emails that were sent much later, in June of 2020. One of the big things that JS focused on in her testimony was Exhibit 6, which is that flyer that was created with William Barr and with her picture. But whether or not it was reasonable for her to be fearful on May 7th, whether or not it was objectively causing that fear, that's not relevant to that analysis. She didn't know about any of that information on May 7th. I think if the harassment or the stalking charge would have still been in play, that's relevant for that analysis. But whether or not there was a reasonable likelihood that his action would have caused fear, whether or not she actually did feel that fear, and whether it was objectively reasonable, the June 2020 information, emails, response, those aren't relevant to the May 7th, 2019 analysis, in my opinion. The district court did hear a lot of evidence about that, those later emails, those later events and things like that. And I think what the record is really muddies with this presentation is whether or not her fear was actually present on May 7th, 2019. I would argue that the fear really came with the follow-up emails in June of 2020, and it's important to note that that's 13 months later. That's when the specificity came. I think the record indicates that Exhibit 6 really was what made her reasonably in fear that she was being targeted and that Ule was going outside and looking for other evidence.
What did she testify to with respect to that?
In terms of when that fear occurred?
Right.
It was pretty vague. He asked a lot of questions.
She didn't roll out May 7th, I doubt.
She said that there were some caustic statements initially, but she almost immediately went to what she did, the behavior she took upon, she was talking about actually changing her LinkedIn profile and things like that, which clearly are attributable to the June 2020 email or handbill, whatever it's called. There was questioning on cross as well about when she reported this incident, and she was pretty vague. But what we do know is that
she did report it. She just didn't report it to the police.
She said something to her supervisor. That was about the nature of the record.
But that's a report.
But
I realize you can you know, make whatever you want to about an argument at trial, but or a hearing, but that was a report that she made.
I think one thing that I think is important to note is JS is an attorney too. And so she knew she could report this, presumably she knew she could report this to the police. And that's the step to take. I mean, I think it cuts against the reasonable, that she was in reasonable apprehension of fear on May 7th, 2019, that she didn't do that, that she didn't report it to police. And I think that that break in time for those 13 months is really what cuts against the argument that that she was in reasonable apprehension of fear of bodily harm.
Although didn't she testify that she felt that the report she made was sufficient to address her concerns? I mean, I'm paraphrasing.
I know you are, and I, yeah. Your Honor, I think that's, to be honest, I think that's a little bit vague. I mean, her concerns, did they rise to that level, did they not? She said she made some comment to her supervisor, but that she was in constant contact with him. So it wasn't a formal, to my belief is the record doesn't say that it was a formal complaint report. It was this, it sounds more like this is what's going on. She says that in a meeting.
Based on the jury's verdict, don't we have to infer that it found, as a matter of fact, that her fear was sufficient on May, based on the May communication?
I think the hard part with this case, Your Honor, is how much the Spriegel evidence really muddied the water.
Well, I understand that. But as to the finding, the jury must have found that she was sufficiently fearful based upon the May communication.
I agree. I mean, if assuming that they followed the law and went through right. The elements, I agree that they made that finding.
Right. Your argument is just that the Spriegel evidence unfairly influenced the jury to make that finding.
Yes, I agree. I mean, it significantly influenced it. Could I just add one or two things? I know
I'm
out of time.
Well, your time's expired, but you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Okay,
and you can
thank
go
you.
For it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Nate Summers. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. This court should affirm Mr. Ouellet's conviction, and I apologize, I might call him Ouellet a couple times here. Mr. Ouellet's true threats to the BCA were not protected by the First Amendment. The First Amendment allows for free trade of ideas and a petition to the government, but it stops well short of threatening a mass shooting at the BCA. Secondly, the jury was provided with sufficient evidence to determine both that Mr. Ouellet created reasonable apprehension, that he would follow through on his threat, and that he intended or acted in reckless disregard of creating that apprehension. And finally, the district court did not abuse its discretion in admitting Spriegel evidence or instructing the jury about its proper use. And even if it did, I think a very complicating part of this case is the fact that Mr. Ouellet called the precluded Spriegel witness, so it's difficult for him to show prejudice. I had thought I would talk about true threats to begin with, but I do want to push back on one piece that I heard this morning. Context of this case is super important. That's why the Spriegel came in. Context of the additional emails, so the June 2020 email is also important because it shows that Mr. Ouellet isn't just sending an email, he's acting on it, right? That original email says, I've got your name, I can look it up. The following email with the screenshot of JS's LinkedIn account shows that he's going to do that, right? This isn't just an email, too, that JS can just let sit in her spam folder. She's required by her job duties. Even if Mr. Ouellet didn't pick out JS as his victim, the BCA essentially provided it to her to him, and he went rolled with it, I guess, is the way to put it. JS, like I said, was required to respond to these emails. It's not something that she could just let sit. She can't just ignore them. She has to respond and let them know how to follow the protocol.
How specific is the evidence regarding JS's, the testimonial evidence, regarding the point at which JS became fearful that Mr. Ouellet would act out on the threats?
Yeah, I guess I read the transcript's a little bit differently. It sounds to me like she was scared when she started calling her names. And that was before.
What is the testimony that is most precise on the
point? Testimony I would point to is volume 2 at 102 and 113, where she testifies that she felt terrified, threatened, and intimidating by that May 7th email. I read that as just the charged email. It might be referencing to the later emails, but she specifically testifies, I felt threatened, I felt terrified, I felt intimidated. She also talks about...
I understand. I'm just trying to get a sense of to threatened, intimidated, specifically by the emails before or after May 17th, or on May 17th. That's what I'm trying to get a sense of. How specific was her testimony about the email that triggered her fear?
Yeah, I mean, my read is that she was terrified from that email, right? The fact that they fell off kind of gave her a little bit of...
Now, when you say that's your read, I'm just trying to get a sense of what language in her testimony establishes your read.
Right, and I would point to, like I said, volume 2 at 102 and 113, where she talks about her sense after reading the emails.
Can you quote specifically the testimony that would most support her fear occurring before, not after, but before or at the time of the charged offense,
and
the charged emails?
Hopefully I'm you know, not beating a dead horse, but she testified that she felt terrified, threatened, and intimidated by the emails. Also the fact that she went...
By the emails?
Sorry, by the... Well, I think it's... I don't have it in front of me. I apologize.
That's fine. If you don't have it, we can track it down.
Yeah. But like I said, I would point to 102 and 113. She also testified that she learned self-protection techniques and asked security to watch her when she leaves the building. And that's direct evidence, right? I think this court might struggle with what evidentiary standard, because there is direct evidence to especially the reasonable apprehension.
I don't get a sense that Mr. Olay is challenging the fact that she was fearful. I think the challenge is whether the fear is based upon the Spriggle evidence that he argues is inappropriately admitted or based on the email that supports the charge.
I'm not sure I follow the question, sorry.
Well, I don't think there's a dispute that JS was in fear. As I understand the argument, the question is whether the fear was based upon the emails that are the basis of the charge, or whether the fear is based on or influenced by the Spriggle evidence after the emails that support the charge.
And I don't think, I mean, this court shouldn't look at the case just as one email, right? If it's just one email, we lose. If this is just an off-the-cuff single email that she can ignore, too, then it's not, I don't think it rises to the level of... a threat of violence, although I guess it is also a very violent email. The context is what matters, right? This isn't just his first email to JS. He knows JS. He can look her up. He's got her name. He knows where she works. He knows she works downtown in St. Paul, and has followed through on some of his other threats to look her up on the net, that sort of thing. So I don't think this is a case that, I mean, any kind of First Amendment case, you have to look at the context, and context is important in this one. I don't disagree with that. I think, too, the Spriggle evidence shows that JS's apprehension was reasonable, because you look at the other two Spriggle victims and testify the same thing. It goes to the lack of a mistake here, right? This isn't just... Mr. Ouellette, oh, whoops, I said the wrong thing. This is a repeated situation where, he's repeatedly threatening government employees when he doesn't get the answer that he wants. And it works, right? It worked for JS. She eventually went up to the top levels of management, said, let's bend the rules a little bit and do the data practice review and get him his information. Turns out there's no information. It also worked with MJ and MF2, which was, you know, the Spriggle witness that that he called himself. Which I think turns to one of the more interesting parts of this case is the fact that Mr. Ouellette called the precluded Spriggle witness. I think he's going to have a really hard time showing prejudice when the district court said, state, you can't call MF because it's unfairly prejudicial. And Mr. Ulay said, okay, I'm going to call her. I think it's really difficult to show that, that prejudice was unfair with the two allowed witnesses when Mr. Ulay made a tactical trial decision to call MF. And then to the jury instruction, I think it's clear that Mr. Ulay was asking for just an instruction on intent, not intent, motive, lack of mistake, which was the district court's order. I should say both district court's orders, right? Both Judge Cahill and Judge Jansen both agreed that that should come in as intent, but also lack of mistake and motive. And so asking for a jury instruction that misunderstood and misstated the district court's order clearly would have been error, so the district court didn't go with it. And I don't think that Mr. Ulay can show that the district court abused its discretion by correctly instructing the jury. I think the last point I want to highlight is the fact that this isn't a conditional or a vague threat. In context of the true threats First Amendment argument. There's no if or then in the statement, right? It seems like mass shootings happened at the BCA. I wouldn't press your luck if I were you. JS doesn't know what pressing your luck means, right? The only thing JS can do is continue to tell him, here's the protocol to follow. And that's, you know, her job duty, right? So it's not like she can continue to press her luck. She's not actively reaching out to message Mr. Ulay. She's just doing her job. It's also not vague. Well, I should say, too, in the conditional nature, the threats of violence statute covers indirect threats, right? So you think of the classic mob statement, sure, it would be a shame if somebody broke your knees if you don't pay our protection racket. That's still a threat, right? You don't have to say, I'm going to commit mass shooting on March 1st, yada, yada, yada. It can be an implied threat, too. And frankly, that's maybe a little bit more terrifying, right? If it's implied, because you're kind of.
Well, there's a difference between whether there's a threat and whether the threat is conditional.
Right.
Yes.
Yes, I would agree with that.
I mean, there's threatening language, but focus on, but I would not push my luck if I were you. That obviously cuts both ways for the appellant. If I were you, makes it very personal, but I would not. But I would not push my luck. Are you disputing that that is a conditional?
I am disputing that that's conditional, because what does pushing your luck mean, right? JS is answering an email as part of her job duties. It's not like she's, I mean, what does pressing your luck mean? It's not like the case where the protester says, if LBJ hands me a gun, I'm going to shoot him. Well, that's if then. There's no if then in this case. There's no if you press your luck, because what does that mean? It's like the, I want to say the Nolan case more recently, where, and it's not cited in the briefs, I can send the court a letter about this afterwards, where, or maybe it's Norman, where the officers are outside the door, about to execute a search warrant, defendant calls 911, I want to say, and says, if anyone comes in here, then I'm going to shoot them. Well, there's an F then there, but the officers have a legal obligation, a legal duty to go in. So that wouldn't be a conditional either under the...
It's a non-precedential case?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Can you identify a precedential case that supports your view about the effect of a condition on a threat?
I think the LBJ case, right, that the Watts case, is the one that says that if it's conditional, then it's not a true threat. And this is obviously not that situation where it's not a conditional threat.
That's what I'm trying to get a sense of. Why is this not conditional?
Because there's no condition. There's no, if you do this, then I'll do that.
Well, it's vague, but it's, I wouldn't push my luck if I were you.
Well, I mean, then I guess I would point back to what does push my luck mean, right? JS doesn't know what she shouldn't do to avoid the mass shooting. Don't push your luck, okay.
Does the vagueness of the condition make it less of a condition?
No, I would say it makes it... I'm sorry, I don't think I understand your question.
Does the vagueness, you know, I wouldn't push my luck. He doesn't tell her what that means. Does the vagueness of it determine whether it's conditional?
I think so, because you need to, if you're like in contract law, if you're going to make a condition, you need to state what that condition is. If you don't state what the condition is, then you don't know how to execute on the contract. Same thing here. Don't push your luck. What does that mean? I have no idea, so I have no idea how to avoid this mass shooting that you've just threatened. If that answers your question.
Not entirely. I understand the difficulty of your position. I'm just trying to ferret out whether there's a case out there that suggests what you're suggesting, which is that if this is a condition, the vagueness of it makes it not a true condition.
Oh, okay.
I think that's what you're arguing, and I'm trying to see right. if there's some case law that supports that.
I guess then I would point to...
That's assuming we interpret it as a condition. I'm not saying we would.
Right, but and that's fair, too.
I wouldn't push my luck if I were you. It does have a bit of a flavor of a condition.
I guess I would point to the Ketterling case, then, the deep state, where, you know, the threat is to we're going to kill everyone in the deep state. Well, who is the deep state? That's too vague, right?
But that's not a condition.
Threaten a person. But it does go to the vagueness, I think.
Well, it goes to the vagueness of the target. I'm talking about the vagueness of the condition.
In that case, I don't think I have a case for you. Certainly not off the top of my head. I think it's also important to note, and I think this goes back to the context of my closing minutes here, that this isn't a statement to like-minded individuals. He's not teaching a class. He's not at a rally. He's not just shouting into the void of the internet, right? This is directed at a person, a named person, a person that he knows, at least the name of, can look her up on the net, as he says, and does later on. This is an email directed at a victim, and the victim knows that he knows that too. And I think one of the more terrifying aspects of this case is that she doesn't know what he looks like. Even though there's this allegation that I think it's St. Paul police have his phone photo or driver's license photo. As far as she's concerned, he could be anybody on the street. That's why she's scared to walk to her car. Again, goes to the context. Context is important both in the true threats aspect as well as the sufficiency. With that, I see I'm running out of time. If there are any other questions?
Doesn't appear to be. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent or for appellant, any rebuttal?
Just briefly. I wanted to focus a little bit on...
Good, just for the audio recording, go ahead and state your name.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
I'm Peter Dahlquist. I'm the attorney for the appellant.
Thank you.
I wanted to highlight just a few things that opposing counsel brought up, and I think the court is kind of concentrating on. I would absolutely argue that this is... there's a precondition or a condition to this threat. I think, actually, the conjugation of "I would" indicates that there must be some further action before, in Ule's mind or in what Ule is stating, you get to that point. It's just like Watts, where the indication from his email is not that they're at that point or that he's at that point. It's that there are still additional steps that would have to occur before that would be the case. I wanted to go a little bit into the Spriegel evidence and the Spriegel...
As you discuss the Spriegel evidence, could you please address how it is that you can establish prejudice, both on that and as to the jury instruction argument?
I was going to absolutely get into that. So, and I'm conscious I only have 4 minutes. So there were several arguments about whether or not the Spriegel evidence was admissible or not. There were two rulings, one from Judge Cahill, one from Judge Jansen, that the two Spriegel incidents were admissible. Ule repeatedly brought that up. So I think those instances were incredibly damaging. If you look at the record, I agree, he did bring up the third witness, but if you look at the record, Ule is basically throwing his hands up at this point saying, if these two witnesses that are this damaging, the Department of Labor and Industries witness, the Department of Public Safety, if they're already in, the damage has been done. And he even says something like that. He says, when he's asking for the instruction, he says that the Spriegel witnesses are already so damaging. So I don't think that is necessarily a trial strategy, because there's no way he would have started out calling all three of the witnesses.
But I think you also pointed out in your initial presentation that some of that Spriggle evidence cuts both ways, because he wanted to show there was context in that he just spoke like that and it wasn't a true threat. So
I think there's I think there is a little bit of that, but to be honest, I mean, the language in those Spriggle instances were so inflammatory. I mean, it's clear that he was trying to keep it out in the first place. And then at that point, once he makes the decision, once it's in, and once it's ruled in by two different judges, he's trying to make any lemonade he can out of these lemons. I mean, he's trying to do that. And then I agree, there is that positive aspect to it. Does it outweigh the incredibly negative aspect of these repeated types of, you know, the AR-47 and AR-15, AK-47 comment, the chain gang or chain gun, I don't know what that is, but those comments are incredibly damaging. In addition, all the...
If you're finished answering that question, I had a...
I
want to take you back to your argument that the 1:27 a.m. communication was conditional. There was a communication that followed that one.
There was.
Okay, so first you have this, I would not push my luck if I were you, the reference that the state argues is a threat, mass shooting, and specifically focusing on her. Let's assume that's conditional for a moment. But within 30 minutes, he writes to her, "So I assume I did not get through to you with my previous message." Why doesn't that remove the condition?
I think it, in essence, I think that removes the threat. I would argue the opposite, that he basically, this shows why this is not a conscious disregard of a known threat. He makes the statement at 1:27. Mm-hmm. I think he knows that she's not reading these emails in real time. I'm just speculating there. But then he sends the next email. It's 17 minutes later. And he's basically saying, I read that as almost an implicit retraction of the prior email. Fine, I'll go through the process. I'll send you a real.
Why isn't that a retraction? At least arguably a retraction, one that the jury could conclude is a retraction of the condition. I wouldn't push my luck if I were you. And he goes on, still angry. So I assume I did not get through to you with my previous message. I didn't get through to you with I wouldn't push my luck. He's making the assumption. He's telling her, "I've just made an assumption about the condition." Why isn't that a reasonable way a juror might interpret that?
I think that's, I think that's a stretch. I mean, he doesn't say anything that furthers the threat at that point. He doesn't make any concrete statement. He doesn't say he intends to do that. In fact, the way I read that follow-up email is he's saying he will go back and comply with the requirement to identify himself.
If he said that, that might be one way to interpret it, but he doesn't. He says, if you don't believe who I am, you can contact the police department, St. Paul Police Department chief of police, and the commissioner of the state. They are useless scum, but they know who I am.
I mean, I don't...
Why isn't that... That sounds like it emphasizes the threat. Like, you can believe that what I meant... they know who I am. They know how dangerous I am. I'm assuming this is a reasonable way a juror might interpret these two emails together.
I think this is part of the problem with email. I think it's part of the problem with text messaging, too, is that to read context into written word is difficult. I think that's...
So we're left to...
try to determine whether, in reality, he was acting in reckless disregard.
We're not left. The jury is left to make that determination.
The jury is left to try to make that determination, and they heard all these other emails and tried to make that determination based on evidence not only of this, but then also the evidence from 13 months later as well. So I think that's part of the hard part with a case that's by email and that's over such a short period of time. It's five emails in the middle of the night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your briefing and your argument on this matter. Mr. Dahlquist, Mr. Stoner, both of you. Both your clients should be happy with your representation today. Nicely done. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. And although we have a case scheduled for oral argument after this one, it's by Zoom. This is our last in-person argument. So we are therefore in recess. Thank you.